Terry Tapp is a red worker from a red state. He's also an artist and a writer, and his book, A Serf's Journal, the story of the United States' longest wildcat strike, is coming out from Zero Books in 2017. Micah Utrich of Jacobin magazine blurbed the book this way. Every day, millions of people grind their ways through miserable work, and every day, a few of them decide the status quo cannot stand. They have to fight back. Very few of either of those stories ever gets told, particularly by the heroic people who've lived it. Terry Tapp does both in a tale of unbelievably miserable, dangerous work and courageous, fed-up workers up against incredibly tall odds. Anyone who has worked a terrible job should read this book. Anyone who has dreamed about fighting back should study it. It's Wednesday, February 15th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. This week, I'm visiting family in Colorado Springs, Colorado, and recording through the microphone of my laptop. So forgive the sound quality and the lack of the usual canned introduction. Thanks goes out to the Zero Books Club members and to Zero Books Club readers. Join today for a second podcast called Inside Zero Books, and look for the Zero Books YouTube channel. Right now, you're listening to the Billy Moon Experience's cover of Bill Murray's Shine On Harvest Moon. That's Shine On Harvest Moon. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Terry Tapp and I describing America's longest wildcat strike. Thanks for listening. Terry Tapp is a fine artist based in New York City. He's also a tattoo artist. His book, A Serf's Journal, is due out this year from Zero Books, and it tells the story of a wildcat strike at Jeff Boat, the largest inland shipyard in the United States. And also, the strike was the longest wildcat strike in U.S. history, and Terry was right in the center of it. Terry Tapp, thank you for coming on to the Zero Squared podcast. I look forward to your book coming out this year.
I appreciate you doing that, man, having me on here.
Why don't you start actually by filling in some of your bio? How did you, you grew up working class, you ended up in this, at the Jeff Boat. How did that come about?
I grew up in rural and somewhat small town Kentucky. Mm-hmm. That was and mainly, you know, 70s, 80s. And I bounced around with different jobs. Went to school for a little bit. I've written some. In terms of my own personal continuity, I've always been an artist, a visual artist, as well as I consider myself still a budding philosopher. Mm-hmm. It's taken a while to read as much philosophy as I've wanted and to calculate an approach, if that makes sense, you know, especially with the world changing as fast as it has been the past couple of decades. But I was living off my art a little. I was doing some comics. I was living in an old farmhouse in Kentucky. I had moved around some, and I ended up moving back to Kentucky and was living outside of Louisville, Kentucky, that old farmhouse. And I lived off paintings and things for a little bit, then would do construction, welding, things like that, carpentry.
Back in the 90s?
Yeah, the late 90s, mm-hmm. Very late 90s. And my wife was pregnant, and I wanted insurance for her. So among other jobs, I took finally one in Jeff Boat Shipyard. So that's and what was funny is that the insurance was terrible. It's absolutely terrible. But it was one of the few jobs you could get that would give you insurance, without paying extra for it.
So it didn't cover enough in terms of the pregnancy?
It was an 80-20 plan that didn't cover dental, didn't cover visual. it covered very little.
But it was enough for getting her through the pregnancy, though.
Yeah. Right. And a lot of it we paid out of pocket anyway. But yeah, it's I took it for that reason and didn't intend to keep it for long. But I guess what had happened that really spurred this book on and spurred the Wildcat eventually was that I don't do well in uniforms and I don't do well with authority. And so when I had taken a number of jobs and usually just ended up sabotaging things, destroying the situation I was in. But I had taken a couple of jobs in restaurants before I was working at that shipyard and had been reading more and more labor history. And I thought, I don't know why it never occurred to me, because my family members are all, they're all union members. Mm-hmm. And they were involved in strikes, legal strikes, which is a whole other topic we can get to about what that division means historically and contemporarily. Mm-hmm. But and I knew and I had been involved with these things myself. So I don't know why I'd never applied any of history to what I was doing. And I started doing it. We had a couple of walkouts at different restaurants, just a couple of job actions, people would say, slowdowns at different construction sites, things like this that really started to give me a little control in that aspect of my life. And so when I started the shipyard, I didn't intend to keep the job that long, but I was there for like 3 years, and I didn't realize how dangerous it was, how little it was in terms of – safety regulations were applied to it.
Uh-huh.
But once I got in there and saw this and things were happening and realized that I had to keep the job for a while at least,
uh-huh.
And my life was potentially at risk. More so than other jobs for which it was at risk, that I could apply these techniques. And that's what I started doing.
From what you'd read about labor history.
Yeah. I never wanted to be involved with a group, but I joined the IWW at that time. And I joined the IWW just because it was the only group that was, to me, successful at actually doing something historically and contemporarily. And at the same time, they tend to stay out of politics. In fact, it's kind of written in like the old Baptists were, where you can't have an authority figure in your church, which obviously that's not true now.
Uh-huh.
But they, at the time, they were almost like, Shakers and Quakers. And they still are, actually. You couldn't have a political candidate. You couldn't have a political position. It was action-based. And I liked that. And a lot of my techniques that I was using came from the old IWW history and contemporary things too, mine workers, things I knew about from my own history in Kentucky, family history, and things like
that.
Did you
join the IWW before you started working at the?
I did actually. I joined it in '98 because I was working at a restaurant then. And actually, I was reading Dishwasher Pete. I don't know if you remember him and his zine. He traveled around working at different places as a dishwasher and ended up on David Letterman and things like this. But I had been editing and reviewing zines for people, mm-hmm. at the time. And I came across his breakdown of what was going on with the Service Workers Union, IWW history, and it got me interested. I knew about them because I read voraciously, but I didn't really research them. And then I found that there was a delegate in Louisville and contacted him and joined. It didn't really, at the time, that didn't really help me, just because there was one guy and, there's not much that can be done with two people, it seemed.
Right.
And so initially it was nothing. But then from that point on, I started the shipyard and things began to take shape.
I was once involved in trying to organize a union at my workplace years ago, actually, around the same time, maybe around 2002. And at that point, you had to join a union, you had to be... you had to have your whole workplace join the union. An individual couldn't just go and join the union. And, but at the IWW, you were joining an organization. You could do that as an individual. You didn't even have to be organizing your workplace.
Yeah. And, interestingly, the shipyard was unionized already. was unionized through the Teamsters.
Right.
And actually through Teamsters 89, which is the largest union in that region, largest local in that entire region. And that's what was interesting about it, because as I was working there, it became obvious to me that the union was purposely working with the company to make sure that nothing would happen, that the status quo was maintained. And so people were very anti-union,
even though
we ran.
The conditions were bad despite the fact that you were that it was a unionized job.
Right.
Right. And tell me about, in your book, there's this great description of you looking at the barbed wire at the top of the fence around the shipyard and having sort of an epiphany. Tell me about
that. Yeah, that actually, in the book, it's depicted as an epiphany, but it was a slow growing thing where I'd moved back to Kentucky and I was trying to farm a little, trying to live off my art, which was, I've been successful on and off and now for some years.
Uh-huh.
But at the time, it was very much on and off. And I was noticing more and more that there was a growing police presence, you know, in this like old rural road there, that I knew people. This was back in the 90s, late 90s, but I knew people in ELF. And, you know, I don't think it's violating any laws to say it now, but people that were having troubles would come. I had 90 acres around me and throw tents. Mm-hmm. And, you know, people involved in actions that were considered illegal. And I was finding out more and more about the encroachment of law enforcement into actions, into people's lives, more so than now it's obvious. But at the time, I was finding out more and more about people, you know, doing actions in the Northwest, people having, there was a big movement to sabotage equipment, you know, from mountaintop removal.
Yeah.
And there was more spying than the kind of jokey, you know, almost cartoonish idea we have of it. And so when I had to take the job at the shipyard, in the book, the book is truthful, but I tried to compress that observation into one moment.
Mm-hmm.
And what eventually happened is, being in the shipyard, you had to enter, you know, through gates that locked you in. And you've got barbed wire up there, and then you have the Ohio River on the other side. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I got sick, very sick. You know, you're breathing metal dust. There's all types of chemicals and things going into the air. I had to leave, and I was ill. I was running a fever, and I couldn't get out. You know, there's a little radio by one of the gates, and the gates look like prison gates. And I told them, I said, you know, I have to leave. I have 104 temperature. I must get help. You know, and they were like, well, we're going to check on it. And I said, you know, screw you. Let me out. And it struck me then, I'm actually trapped. You know, you have to argue with someone. It makes what you're doing, your position, very obvious.
What kind of work was it that you did in the shipyard? Was it mostly one kind of thing, or was it a variety of things? Or what
it was different things. You usually start out as a laborer. They give you a yellow hard hat to start out with and a bucket, and you go clean. You go into the side boxes of barges and clean, you know, clean metal. I mean, it's not like sweeping. You're just doing grunt work. And then you can train. You can go up to and be a welder. I eventually became a first-class pipe fitter, you know, on tankers and things. But you can become a steel fitter. I did that too. I mean, it's just – it's wide open. They have riggers. They have painters. Painters, big spray painting of, you know, anti-rust paint for the barges and things.
Mm-hmm.
But you can do a variety of things. But most people start out as essentially a grunt. And they give you about – I forget if it's 30 or 90 days before they put you in the union. But it's dangerous work already, just like carpentry, just like mining, just like other welding jobs and things. It's all dangerous work. But if you look at how unregulated it is, there's a facade of regulation that goes on through OSHA. And OSHA, I contacted the Southern OSHA that was in charge of this,
mm-hmm.
and some other jobs too. Very helpful people. and very sad. I'm skipping topics, but I contacted them when I was welding for an exhaust plant. Interestingly, a French-owned plant with great benefits, great unionization, amazing hours in France, and a shitty sweatshop, anti-union sweatshop in the U.S. Same company, Faurecia. But when OSHA came, they set it up, and they made OSHA stay in the corner, and they set up a phony environment, clearly. And I worked with OSHA. I was so enraged. I contacted OSHA afterwards, and they knew they were being set up. And I said, you know, that people are losing limbs. This is a whole other workplace later. But, you know, and OSHA said, we know, but we have no power. And we're honestly trying to be helpful. But I contacted OSHA before when I was at the shipyard, too, and they sent me a book of regulations, a few of which were implemented. Most of which was just terrible.
Would you say up until that point, this job in the shipyard was the most dangerous job you'd done?
There were others. I mean, I was a roofer for a while. And again, you know, we had people from Cape Cod come down to Kentucky. And the lack of regulations in Kentucky shocked them. You know, when you have a lead man over the roofing crew whose half of his body is immobilized from falling, and he gives you a couch cushion in case you fall off a three-story hip and gable, that's not really reassuring. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Shit. But go ahead.
I'm just going to say, so the conditions were terrible when you started. And what happened to, I mean, eventually a wildcat strike developed.
Well, what happened initially, what I was doing is I'm staying up all night as best I can, you know, working a lot and painting, writing and things. I had been working on a book, you could call it an anti-civilization book at the time. And I kept meeting people mainly from ELF, the Earth Liberation Front.
Right.
And other wobblies and people coming through and different.
Were the other people in like ELF, the other activists you knew, workers like you? For the most part?
Most of them, yeah. There were a few people that were, how would I put it, academics. They were still crusted over with the stink of an academic institution. I hate to put that. But you know what I'm saying? They had no sense. There was, in fact, if I can be rude on this, there was a wonderful guy came through from Seattle and wanted to go into the mountains and explain to people something about the ties between environmental damage and racism. And it was funny because there were activists there who come from an academic background or a more middle-class background. I mean, that's a little fair.
Yeah.
And upper middle class. And then there were people like me that come from the other half of that. Right. And those people on the other half, my side, we all began to shake our heads because somebody just shoot him. Basically, you're telling white people that they're not white. And this is all these poor people have to grasp onto. You're not white, really. Race doesn't exist. So don't sell your lumber, the little wood you've got to keep your house. How about that? And that's not going to go over.
Wait. Explain to me what he was asking exactly. So there, you got this middle class guy going to people who would sell their lumber to get for money to get through
in the mountains, like in eastern Kentucky. Uh-huh. You have a lot of people that sell whatever they've got. They grow a little weed, or they sell, you know, some trees basically from their land and put it on a flatbed and drive it, and you know, stay financially afloat if they can. And he had these ideas about race that are basically, to me, on target of the fiction of race. Uh-huh. And he was interested in talking to people about what was happening with mountaintop removal, what was happening with erosion of lands, why, you know, this is a failed strategy to sell off what resources you have, that there are other strategies. And it tied in wisely overall with, you know, the idea of race as a fiction and as a political tool to keep people.
Do you remember how it tied in the two things?
No, it actually didn't tie in the mountains because of the it's racially homogenous pretty much, at least over there. The point is that he had these ideas as he was explaining it. I agreed with everything he said, but you know, somebody would just shoot him is the point, and that was what we started laughing about. He was upset that we said it, but that's what would happen. So, you know, somebody would be very upset, thinking he's, you know, as he's trying to explain to them these complicated connections that he got out of
a book.
He just
thought it was a good idea to go up into the mountains and explain theory to these people, basically.
Essentially, yeah. And what kind of approach is that?
I don't think it's a good one. I don't know.
It's a horrible one. But no, what got all this started? I was writing this anti-civilization book, and then I decided that kind of in line with what we're talking about now, it was a bunch of shit. You know, it's wonderful to put these ideas down. And I still write a lot of theoretical things. But what I wanted was something that you could pick up anywhere and that most people could read it. And I would give concrete examples of what I was talking about. So you don't get any sort of leftist, you know, academic, anything coming in it. You get something you could hang out with, you know, at night when you're at home after work. You could take the lunch with you, do whatever. And you see things like that damn barbed wire fence and a gate you can't get out of. Mm-hmm. And the reality of it becomes overwhelming.
Right.
So it started turning into a memoir laced in with ideas about politics, civilization, and things that I thought were somewhat original. Maybe yeah. Totally, maybe not.
Terry,
but then
because of the political moment we're in, this division between, I don't know, the middle class or the academic left and the kind of left you come out of and what you're talking about seems really important to me, like right now, like in the era of Trump, you know. Do you feel like you have any special insight into how to overcome the division between the classes on the left?
I don't feel I have any, but in my experience, practically, and whether people seem to feel I have a lot. I say that because in Louisville, Kentucky, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, whatever we call that decade, mm-hmm. There was this upsurge of radical activity and successful radical activity.
Yeah.
And it eventually died down. And I remember when it was dying down and what produced that dials. But I also remember what was making it successful. And in part, you know, there are a lot of hard things that people don't confront. Changes have gone on geographically, changes that have gone on technologically, and so forth, that as I don't even like to put a label on any political view right now, but just saying as a leftist, that I think we are unable to articulate properly at the moment.
Can you give me an example?
For instance.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The Communist Party came through Louisville, and they had heard about this before the Wildcat. They had heard about all these strike or the actions that were going on before, which were, to me, just as important and led up to what happened, which we can get into, and it's in the book as well.
Yeah.
But they wanted someone to speak, and they came to me. Excuse me. They came to me, and I tried to explain to them. They had a meeting in this park. I didn't want to speak for them. I didn't want to speak for anyone. But the point is, they privilege having a job. And it's difficult to sell people the idea of a good life by a job. And I think as leftists, we ate a rotten sandwich on this many years ago. As a kid growing up in a working class, rural, semi-small town, whatever environment, with no internet, and for the most part, they eventually start putting cable TV in. So you're isolated. You're in the 14th century, especially a kid with a restless mind and a lot of already wanted to make. The last thing I wanted to do was have a job.
Right.
So when I started going to high school, you know, and I'm clearly a terrible student. And I looked over my job possibilities. There was nothing I wanted to do. And when you tell people, you know, we've got a message and it's so unclear, you want people to be able to think of a sustainable life far from the worries of having to pay the bills or not paying the bills, the worries of putting food on the table and those practical realities. Right. But what most people want is something much more vibrant and creative. Most people, not everyone. But the point is, if you're selling a Marxist idea of a better paying, horrible job, that's really difficult to sell. When I, you know, my father, my grandfather, all these people, they were going to get me jobs, you know, welding. They're going to get me jobs as a pipe fitter, as a miner, as a, some job that I would hate. And I did some of these things, and I did hate them. Yeah. I didn't hate them as much as I would have office work. But what I wanted was to draw and paint all day and think up intriguing theories and examine my world. And sometimes, like, play with interesting crops that I was growing out in the woods, you know. I mean, that sounds like pot, but organic heirlooms and things.
Okay.
You know, that's what I wanted to do. And when we try and sell people this idea of the horrible workaday world, but better pay or a better benefits, that's not alluring to people. So we have to be able to say, and yet at the same time, you have to be able to articulate a vision that doesn't include, you know, the wolf at the door.
Right.
Academics get screwed up on this. When I talk with academics, I'm not trying to pick on them.
No, no.
There's just such a distance between academic leftist theory and reality. And so many academics view the vision they want to convey, or the vision conveyed by leftist ideas, as that, as a horrible, boring life, but with better benefits. Hmm. You know, there were some people involved with a magazine. I don't want to in any way go into political squabbling with people. Right. They were involved with a magazine once, and they said, I was at a talk by these people, and they said they wanted to do away with money, which sounds great. That's fine.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine who's just he's unemployed all the time, he said, what would happen if somebody wanted to use money? And they said, well, we'd have to kill them because money's a disease. And I said, well, who's going to figure out how much, like, I get to live on, man? And I said, you know, and they said, well, we would adjust what you're given. And the way they said it, they were all academics, the way they said it, I looked over at this buddy of mine, and it was clear that once you get rid of the forces that are controlling your life now, these guys are ready to step into place. So I think most people sniff that dog out, you know, yeah. And they don't. And that's what people are hearing. You know, I went to some militia meetings back in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I accidentally wandered across the first Tea Party meeting in Central Park in Louisville, the one Rick Santorum called. Yeah. And I've been around these people, and I hate even saying these people because they're just your neighbors.
Right.
But a lot of them basically want what leftists claim they want.
Right.
Leftists and theoreticians, activists, and so forth. But the fact that it's not connecting should tell us we don't understand theoretically what's going on.
Yeah.
As well as practically.
Yeah.
If I can give one more example, then I'll shut up on this.
Okay. No, I love this. This is real. I mean, look, the story that you have to tell is really worth telling. We should get to it. But
yeah, sure.
I feel like this is important to hear. And I have one or two questions maybe about what you said so far, and maybe sure. We can do a little more on it. But anyway, go.
Well, here's
go
one on. More tale just to illustrate the point.
Yeah.
And I will give a name to this because it really upset me. Jobs with Justice.
Uh-huh.
I think Jobs with Justice, they money, and they've done some really good work. There was an organizer for Jobs with Justice, the chief organizer. He was in Louisville. Mm-hmm. And I asked him, he said, you know, you're doing such great work. You know, you should be paid for it. You should be blah, blah, blah. That whole professional activist thing. And I asked him, I said, you know, things aren't going well for you. He said, no, you can't get people interested in anything. And we were doing an early living wage campaign.
Yeah.
I said, you can't get people interested in better pay? He said, no, He said, you know, people aren't educated. They don't know anything. I just can't believe it. I couldn't believe it. So a couple months later, I got a call. We had a number for just radical unionizing, call it what you will. Uh-huh. And it was for me and it was for another guy. I got this call from a couple, married couple. They were broke. They had volunteered for a caterer. And the caterer had catered a big meeting of activists and labor people sponsored by Jobs with Justice.
Yeah.
And so they went to this meeting, and the guy who was the main organizer was speaking, and he was talking about a living wage. And they asked him, they said, how can we find out more about it? And he said, well, who are you with? And they said, well, we're with the caterers. And he was like, oh, you have to get a pamphlet or something, and dismissed them. I was so angry, I called him up and I said, you do understand. You're trying to sell people an idea, which is you do the same thing you do now, but make a lot more money. I said, if I walked down the street and I said, chocolate, pussy, beer, or dick, or whatever you want to say,
yeah.
And I couldn't sell that, any of those, mm-hmm. to the populace, something's very wrong. So the fact that he was not able to convince these people to continue being caterers, but make $5-8 more an hour, tells me what's happening.
Yeah. Well, why did he didn't want to talk to them because they weren't worth an organization?
I don't really understand. And I asked him about it and I didn't get an answer. But, you know, I will say this because this is stuck in my craw for years. And it's in the book.
Yeah.
You know, when we were having our Wildcat, I called them. Uh-huh. And there was a new person in charge of Jobs with Justice. And I said, clearly, you know, like this is a historically major event. And they said, oh, good God, you're right. We're going to have people down there. I said, we've got people internationally calling and we've got people who want to come regionally and nationally. We're going to have this big event. You know, people circling this union hall, which they did. Uh-huh. And they said, well, we'll be on our way. And they never showed up. And I asked a guy, as I was waiting for him, I said, we should do something like call them again. And he said, they're not going to show up. They were blowing smoke up your ass. They did it because a lot of their money comes from the Teamsters Local 89. They're not going to interfere with that money. And he was right.
Yeah.
So they didn't betray us, but
they didn't support you.
They didn't support us. Exactly.
So, okay, what was it that brought the strike together on that shipyard? I mean, there's something about bonuses in your book. Was that the...
But that wasn't it. What had happened is we kept coordinating our actions together. So we would signal each other when things, you know, when we would have to, you know, get out of the rain instead of get electrocuted. Or we would do things. And we also produced a newsletter. So you would know, like, this is the number of the insurance commissioner for the state if you're getting screwed on your insurance.
Right.
Or we would, you know, the threats the company would make for people, we'd make fun of them. You know, the president of the company said he was going to fire people and talk to the union about putting you on permanent suspension, firing you. Because as he watched 8 hours a day out his window, and he would see every now and then people taking long breaks. Then the silliness and irony of that comment can easily be mocked. You know, if you're watching for 8 hours a day and you're paid $100,000. So we did that and we were coordinating things. We had walk-offs and they kept increasing in length until the point that the company just kind of gave up. And we had a contract that came down. We were sure because of what we demonstrated as solidarity, as strength, that the contract would be great. And what happened is the union and the company got together and put a contract that it was there were 3-year contracts. This one was 5. So it extended it far out because they had ocean-going vessels, a big multi-million-dollar contract coming for that, and they didn't want any labor action help. And then they gave us a tiny raise and then increased the payout for the health insurance. Basically, we were going backwards and losing power and signing a document saying this. And then there was something about, I have to go back into this, but we were being, the company had the ability to fire you at will. they could override the union. The union could talk to the company and vote on things without asking you. It was atrocious. And so we were at the union hall, a huge group of us, and we voted to strike. Interestingly, the company and union had titled the strike offer first, final, and last offer. Legal language, meaning a rejection is an automatic strike vote. Well, they rejected it. We rejected it. Uh-huh. And they said, you know, you'll be on the picket line tomorrow. We'll set up sheets. You'll get paid, you know, some portion of your pay from the strike fund that you've contributed to. Uh-huh. And then when we, that night, I had some friends come over and I got a call from the union hall saying, show up at your regular time or face discipline. And that's really what started it. I can't give my approval to intimidation. And so when
so the union said that there was going to be a strike, and then they decided there wouldn't be.
Yeah, and they were threatening people. They didn't say we're going to put a bullet in your head. We're going to burn a cross in your lawn. They said face discipline. And so. In the book, I didn't mention this because I was trying to just go through the main actions. But I went first. My wife and I was married at the time. We were like, what's going to happen? And I told her, I said, I'm not going to go to this. She said, well, they had a history, the unions in Louisville, of some messy action. One guy who was an organizer for the union that used to control Louisville Gas and Electric. Somebody hired the company or the union, I don't know, hired someone to go and take a 2x4 to someone's head on the picket line.
Yeah.
And they picked the wrong guy because he was very capable of hurting this person. He put, yeah. And so we assumed there was something violent. And I had two friends that were clearly not used to that kind of life and wanted to come with me in the morning. Before that happened, my wife and I drove around and we found a few people who had gone on the third shift. So they go in at midnight and they were trying to protest and the police came up, didn't surround them. But it was a couple of cars and they told them they're either getting to work or they're going home, but get the hell out of the shipyard. And they weren't even on it. They were in a parking lot across the road. The next morning I got these buddies of mine out and my wife, and I just told her, we'll hide the car, photograph me as they break my bones. And like that will be because we have a legal right to strike. So that will be what sets it off. But what happened is it's fascinating. I've got photographs of it from her. What happened is you see all these people gather and we forgot to bring anything, to write with. We'd have anything with us. Right. And I went to a dumpster and grabbed cardboard. I had some markers because I like to do graffiti. So we wrote, and legally you can't even strike. So we wrote things like this contract sucks. One lady just walked around with drink milk on this big sign. But you know what you're saying. So, we did that. And then a guy came over to me. But you have hundreds of men lined up just staring at us. No one walking in. There are different gates. So some people did get in. But interestingly, for this, talking about barbed wire, they closed the gates and wouldn't let people out. So you have hundreds out, some dozens inside, and they're trying to climb the gates. They're barbed wire on top, and there's chain link fencing that's like I guess it's about 9-10 feet high, and they're trying to get up it and shaking it, but they won't let them out. So that's how the whole thing started. It was over a contract.
Yeah. So how did it sustain itself?
Wildcat strikes. Which is the legality is a whole other discussion about what's happened theoretically and practically to the left in this country.
Yeah.
But wildcat strikes last usually about an hour, sometimes half a day. They're wide open to prosecution, attacks. There's nothing to protect you from the police just arresting you on site.
Right.
The union doesn't back you. So usually a wildcat. So what happened is this took place and we assumed that we would go down to the union hall and they would say, all right, you're on strike. We bow to this pressure. So people gathered around the union hall. You have 800 people employed here. And what happened is that the union hall said, We can do nothing. We're actually on your side. Our hands are tied. There was a clerical error. 60 days before the negotiations have to proceed, we have to deliver a letter to the company that says we're ready to negotiate, and we forgot. So legally, we could never negotiate a contract for you anywhere, which anyone who passed Logic 101 could break that down. And so so people were confused and angry, but they went back and just started striking.
Yeah.
And I, what I did was I was on a number of, what did we call them back then? You know, different forums and websites and things, yeah. Email lists. So I announced what was happening. And all these people from Norway, France, Canada, Brazil started emailing me and vocalizing their support. So I printed these up and I got in a pickup truck with a megaphone and would ride around announcing, telling people, like, don't stop. This is great. You know, people are supporting us. And interestingly, there are some shops near there, like little stores. They start handing out free food, free water. Mm-hmm. People from the community start bringing free food, beer, you know. Uh-huh. And we had a Teamsters truck that was going to make a delivery of welding rods, you know, an 18-wheeler that stopped. And he was like, what in the hell? We haven't been notified, of course. And he wouldn't deliver. You know, things like this start happening, and it really reinforces your sense of security. So I stayed awake for the first 3 days traveling around, you know, giving people emails or reading them off, you know, letting people know like you're supported. We had different radical activist groups in the community, you know, Food Not Bombs and people bringing food. It was great.
So this is the longest wildcat strike in U.S. history?
Yeah. Well, and let me clarify that too, because that's very important. All strikes at one time were illegal.
Right.
What's happened is that because of the state welding itself to political action, mm-hmm. the state will approve your strike, which means that a certain kind of strike, one that you have control over directly, is illegal. But all strikes before the 30s, essentially, before, you know, the labor legislation was put into place, were illegal.
So it's the first, the longest U.S. wildcat strike since there were wildcat strikes instead of just strikes.
If you struck in 1890, and there, and this can be qualified a lot with little details,
yeah.
because there were trade unions and things like this. But in general, if you struck at one point, a strike was illegal. You could be fired. The police could club you, be arrested. Whatever would happen, and terrible things happen. You know, some strikers were shot. I mean, this is a public.
Right. Of course, just, yeah.
In fact, Alcoa, some of these companies would blow people up on strike lines with bombs. But you could find that in books like Labor's Untold Story. Mm-hmm. But what happened is, you know, as the state stepped in progressively, actually, through Franklin Roosevelt. And you get more and more labor legislation, you have a wider and wider legality extended to strikes.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in the National Labor Relations Board and things like that, I think that's a very big problem. And there's one thing I liked about the IWW, theoretically, in fact, is that they, and I want to push the IWW, not to have any problem with it. I don't care if people join or don't join anything.
Right.
But the point is that they did not favor contracts, because having a contract meant you have some sort of agreement with people that stabilizes the position, the actual solidarity and action you've taken, and doesn't energize you to continue to take further action, leading up to, you know, workers taking over, basically.
Yeah.
But once you get the state involved, and you have that codification of what you've been doing, then you're really screwed. You don't have legal, you have no legal recourse to say, this is wrong. If you look at what the Teamsters said, when they've been clearly colluding with the company.
Yeah.
If they come out and say, according to the law, we had to notify you by letter of 60 days, blah, 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 and we made this mistake, it's a clerical error. Well, then you're screwed. And what do you do? Die? You know, I mean, it was a mistake. I guess the overall point of that is it was a mistake that the left ever became cozy with the state. There were non-state solutions, and worker solidarity and actual left action was vital when you didn't include the state among your friends.
What do you think was the reason that this Wildcat, where was the Wildcat strike going towards? Just a new, better contract? What's the aim of it?
At first, we wanted the honoring of the strike. And the union said that they wouldn't. They were on the side of the company with this. And that really shocked us. So we thought what we could do is enforce the strike by not working. And there's actually a funny moment. I include this in the book where the president of the company sent out a letter to all 800 employees. And he said, "Let me explain what's going on to you at JeffBo. Nothing has been done to you yet." And there's all this couched, intimidating language. Mm-hmm. And I went home and people were like, "Oh my God, what's going to happen?" And I knew what was happening. It's, you know, it's clear dog whistle intimidation. So I went home immediately and I typed up a letter that said, "Let me explain to you what's going on the street in front of JeffBo. We haven't done anything against you yet." You know, and just turned the language around, which was they considered terroristic.
Right.
But the point is that a strike is when you don't work.
Yeah.
And sitting on lawn chairs, walking back and forth across the road in front of Jeff Bode, not working, is a strike, whether the union says it's a strike or not, or Jesus puts his stamp on it. It is a strike. And so we were striking. And nothing was getting done. And interestingly, their multi-million dollar ocean-going contract, the signees for that through the Vane brothers were visiting because this happened right by Derby, Kentucky Derby, which is in that region of Mardi Gras. So they come and they see people sitting around drinking beer, holding signs, flipping you off rather than
work
diligently. Yeah, and so you are on strike. But so we knew, like, just doing what we're doing was a strike. We wanted the union to recognize it. And there was a big movement, and it would have been phenomenal, I think, in terms of labor history and U.S. history. People started agreeing that they would sign up for some other union. And we had meetings talking about what that union would be. We had, I think it was about 20, 30. It was enough to fill a room. IWW members that had signed on that would help with the newsletter and things in different areas of the shipyard. So we talked about the IWW, and there was real interest in signing up for that. So we started moving forward on that. But then the company said, or the union said, that they would work with us and produce a different contract. And it's like I said, this is in the book. But what happened actually is after a week of not working, we went back and then had a meeting the following week with the union. And James Arhoff, one of his top guys, Walt Lytle, came down and with a bunch of intimidating bodyguard people and told us that we had to work, that the contract was good, we will take it, and screw us. So that turned into chaos because IWW members, union activists, local activists had surrounded the union hall, and some crane operators that from Indiana had come down, and people started going nuts. We were pissed. They were intimidating us. But Walt Lytle asked if anybody had any comment, you could come up and, you know, speak your piece. But he stood right by the microphone, and you had these huge guys that looked like Sigmund Freud on steroids, bald with little goatees and knit shirts with their arms crossed. So you got an army. I was like six. It seemed like an army. Six guys around you. Uh-huh. And this guy, you know, but I jumped up on the stage, and a couple of guys told me they were going to basically watch for me, you know. Right. But I jumped up on the stage, and what was crazy is when I jump up and start and take the microphone, I was terrified that these guys were going to clock me from behind. But what was great is I was overcome by this, you know, spirit of the moment. As I look out, there's a sea of men and a few women, too, but mainly men in front of me, angry. and it's six behind me.
Yeah.
So immediately I said, let's get up, you know, fuck them, and start raising hell. People took chairs and were smashing them, throwing things, yelling. Yeah, and it went crazy. And, of course, the Sigmund Freuds and the Teamsters rep didn't know what to do. But, you know, I gave the microphone to other guys, and it went from specific demands to, you know, fuck the world, fuck civilization. If people were just saying anything, which was wonderful. That's what, you know, when I talk to somebody later, he's saying, again, more of these very purely theoretical leftists. He said, you know, there's no point in getting up there and saying, and fuck you too. I said, no, there's ultimately the point of doing that. People who've been contained and taught to be slaves of one form or another their entire lives, having that moment to say fuck you to a person 3 feet away who's directly responsible for the mutilation of their inner life and outer life is beautiful. So, yeah, it went that, and then we had another vote, and they walked around grabbing us and going, this is a good contract. And, you know, it's a secret ballot. And everyone started pulling their ballots out, going, you got a no vote, no vote. So it became, you know, it's 800, well, it was, I think, 500-something attended the meeting against 10, you know, once you look and you see. And so we voted it down, and then we continued to work under this assumption they were coming up with another contract. And they tried the same thing. And then we formed a committee to move things forward. Mm-hmm. But that's where it started to really run into problems, because we really should have stayed out. As hard as it was and as promised we were that this would be resolved, we should have stayed out.
Yeah.
And that's where there are even more problems.
Do you think that the fact that you acted out and got to say it to their faces, actually, I know you say it was important, but did it undermine, or like, was it like a release valve, and that's why you weren't able to stay on strike, or?
No, I actually think, let me back up for a second. One reason I have to say, and I hate saying this as a person with an anarchist orientation, one reason this whole thing worked is that the police force, this is on the northern side of the Ohio River. So technically, it's not in Kentucky, it's in Indiana, and it's in this little town called Jeffersonville.
Yeah.
The police force in Jeffersonville had been working 2 years without a contract and were really pissed off about it. And some of them had worked for the shipyard and knew what happened. Some of them were some of the cops that had to come every couple of weeks and take batons and beat some guy because he's upset at being, you know, ordered to threaten his life or ordered to risk his life for his job. And so this whole situation had already rubbed the police raw. And the very first full day when we were out on strike, somebody, I was told that it was a chief, I really don't know, a representative came into the offices, administrative offices, to talk to the president of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And when he left, I did see this myself. When he left, he shut the door and said, fuck you. Because, you know, fight your own battle or something.
Yeah.
Then about an hour later, a couple of police cruisers come by us and they stick their arms up with a fist. So the rest of the week, the police either gave us the fist in the air or were absent. If they had been able to get batons and start beating people, it would have really changed this. But the fact that they were on the side of, or on our side, really altered the situation. And, you know, everyone, including myself, like guns, and you have guns, and people were talking about bringing guns and being intimidating. And we all agreed, you know, no weaponry of any sort, because it's an immediate legal excuse to jump us. But without that excuse, with the police force in rebellion, the company couldn't do anything.
Hmm.
I guess so. Part of that is pay your cops. But also, in addition, I think what happened is not the release valve. I think it's the lack of an imaginative space to walk into.
Mm-hmm.
We had meetings and began talking about things. People couldn't imagine what could happen next. And I, you know, even where I was coming from, I thought, what do we do? Like, ultimately, do we hang the administrative staff? Do we? The company was eventually owned by Citicorp. They had gone from private ownership to the U.S. Navy to CSX Railroad to Citicorp. So do we hang the main investors, CEO of Citicorp? I mean, it's wonderful to think of it, but is that our goal? Do we take over the shipyard? Do we? I mean, there are fantasies you could have, but all the same, there's not a space to move into. If you're making a painting, you see where it's going to go.
Right.
We still couldn't see where we're going to go. And I think that's really the inner life of people in this country, in this world for the most part, but definitely in this country, has been so denuded by many factors, especially by an assault on our imagination.
Yeah.
That we can't figure out what would happen if we win. And for just a moment, we won. I mean, it was glorious. I've never felt that hopeful about anything in my life.
Yeah.
But where do you go?